The shots ring out across the fields, where dusk has already settled and night is quickly encroaching. The resident nearby hears the shots, but is confused. Their sound carries off into the open space, and she's unsure what she's hearing, until the woman arrives at her door. "She's killed them," she says, "and she needs the police." This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 168, The Matiani Family Murders. This week's sponsor is When Change Happens, a podcast series about ordinary South Africans coping with extraordinary changes in their lives and hosted by legendary journalist Ruda Landman. Subscribe to Change in One Generation on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Iono, or go to changepodcasts.co.za for more information. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Madelise MacDonald, Karen Trott, and Mario Monroy for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today's case is a little baffling. Even after I've gone through all the research and all the accounts, I find it difficult to truly understand what might have happened. You'll hear all of the claims the perpetrator made, and you'll hear how the prosecution responded to those claims, seemingly refuting them. And perhaps, like me, at the end, it still won't make much sense to you. And maybe we don't really want it to. I will warn you up front that this episode includes the death of two children. My sources for this case include an episode of the now award-winning television series Autopsy. Congrats to Dr. Stalf and Staden and her team. 400 combined pages of the judgment and sentencing documents from the court case. And a few other online sources. So, let's get into episode 168, The Matiani Family Murders.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Rehitile Matiane was born Rehitile Tshetlo to her parents, John and Pauline, in 1982. She had three siblings from the same parents as her and one stepbrother. and was raised in what was described as a high-functioning family with stable relationships and socioeconomic status. When she was in primary school, she started suffering with migraines, and these would plague her continuously right into her adulthood. She learned to manage them with pain medication, but the side effects would often last 2 or 3 days. Rehitile matriculated in 2000 and went on to study toward a national diploma in engineering computer systems. When the crime I'll be discussing in this episode occurred, the relationship with the man she would go on to marry was presented as completely normal and without difficulties. And although the normal tag, I'm sure, can still apply, as almost every relationship has some ups and downs, it would later be revealed that the start of it was rather unconventional and quite volatile at times. Rehitile met Maxwell Matiane in 2003, but at the time, he was married to someone else. The nature of their relationship at that time is relatively unknown, and they seem to be on again and off again for some time, but for the most part seem to be a couple, despite Maxwell being married. In 2011, 3 things happened which solidified the future. Maxwell started divorce proceedings to end his marriage. Rehitile took out an interim protection order against Maxwell. And then, once the divorce was finalized in that same year, she married him. Maxwell would later say that the period during which he was divorcing his first wife was very stressful, and it caused a lot of tumult between him and Rehitile too. In the paperwork for the interim protection order, Rehitile expressed that she feared for her safety and claimed that there'd been a history of abuse and violence in her relationship with Maxwell. Rehitile did not go through with the second step of making the interim order permanent, and when she was asked about it after her arrest, she would claim that she'd fabricated the information, and she did it to show Maxwell that he, quote, should not try her or mess with her, end quote. Now, it's almost impossible to say what the truth is here. There wouldn't be any further evidence or complaints of abuse within the couple's relationship after this point. But we can look at this from 2 perspectives. Victims of abuse will very often withdraw charges and deny abuse when faced with possible prosecution of the abuser, because this is the nature of coercive control and the abuse cycle. But it's also not uncommon for abusive partners to take preemptive legal action against their victims in order to cover their own butts and make their victims' lives more difficult. Rehitile herself would, after all, later say that she had lied about the abuse in her relationship when she'd taken out the order, and it was done as a warning to Maxwell to show him what she was capable of. Again, this too could be a sign of an abuse victim making up a story to cover for their abuser. And we also have to consider that when Rehitile would eventually make this retraction and deny that Maxwell had ever abused her, she was in a position where she really needed her husband's support. But that could also mean anything. It could mean she was willing to go to any length to cover up any abuse that had happened in their relationship, or it could mean that she really had lied to get the protection order, and she realized she'd have to own up to that to avoid making her husband look like he was abusive. We'll never really know which it was, and it probably doesn't matter to the case, except when we think about why Rehitile said she'd actually taken out that protection order, to show her husband not to mess with her. Because she would show him that again, in the most terrible of ways. Or at least, the prosecution would say she had. There's also a good possibility that one of the main reasons for Maxwell divorcing his wife and marrying Rehitile is that she was pregnant, because not long after they'd married, she gave birth to their first son together, Keandre. Maxwell was doing incredibly well in his practice as a specialist psychiatrist. He'd built practices in Bloemfontein, Polokwane, and Mahikeng. Brehetile also had her own businesses. The couple were financially successful and started designing and building their dream house. Brehetile became Maxwell's practice manager and graduated with a degree in information and systems. In 2013, she gave birth to the couple's second son, Alvaro. Two of Maxwell's children from his previous marriage also lived with the couple, and according to everyone who would be interviewed afterwards, the family unit was happy and content. Maxwell considered his wife's mental health to be good, and all those around her did too. She looked after her physical health as well, exercising with a personal trainer several times a week and on her own in addition to that. The building of a new house, according to the couple, was the only thing that was a bit stressful in their lives by 2015. But this perfect picture belied an incredible implosion, which was about to take place. The focus of the investigation around this case would be the 3 days on and before Friday the 17th of April 2015. The reason for this will become clear once we get to the trial portion of the episode, as will the seemingly oddly specific information about medication Rehetile may have taken during this period and personal details about her. A normal day for the woman included taking her 2 children and one of her stepchildren to school in the morning, then coming home and having breakfast with her husband. On that Wednesday, she did just that, and then her personal trainer arrived for their scheduled Wednesday session. Rehetile's menstrual cycle had started, and she had cramps, as well as what she described as a tight chest, so the training session was shortened. When the trainer left, she took a few puffs of an asthma inhaler that was actually prescribed for her youngest son. The medication is called Symbicort. The inhaler had originally been prescribed for the boy by his general practitioner, but when the prescription had run out, the boy's father, Maxwell Machane, who of course was a psychiatrist and could prescribe medication, wrote out another prescription. The inhaler was not prescribed for use by Rehetile though, and she would never explain what the chest tightness was related to, but it seemed that she regularly used the inhaler. Symbicort contains budesonide, which is a steroid which reduces inflammation in the body, and formoterol, which is a long-acting bronchodilator that relaxes muscles in the airways to improve breathing. According to Rehetile, her husband had said that the asthma pump would ease her chest tightness, but he would later claim that he hadn't known she was using it. She was uncertain how many puffs she'd used, but estimated she took about 3 or 4 each time she used it. Later on in the day, she would use the pump again, and also took Mypaid Forte, which was prescribed to her by her gynecologist for menstrual cramps. Mypaid Forte is a ibuprofen and paracetamol combination used for pain relief. That Wednesday, she said she hadn't felt different from a mental health perspective, but her energy was very low due to the menstrual cramps and chest tightness. On Thursday, Rehetile said that she developed a very bad headache in addition to her menstrual cramps, and the chest tightness persisted. She once again took several puffs of the Symbicort pump, took Mypaid Forte, and then also took Migril tablets, which she regularly used for headaches and migraines. Migril contains ergotamine and caffeine, which work together as vasoconstrictors to narrow the pathways through the vascular system, and cyclizine, which is an anti-nausea medicine. The latter is included because nausea is a known side effect of migraines, but also because the other ingredients in Migril can also cause nausea. So it's kind of covering all its bases. Rehetile could not say how many migraine tablets she'd taken that day, but said she rarely, if ever, exceeded the recommended dosage. She said that that morning, when she was driving home from dropping the children off at school, she'd suddenly felt very sad and alone. She said she couldn't attribute the feeling to anything specific in her life, but she also suddenly felt suicidal. She said she hadn't felt that way before. Later that night, she told her husband she was feeling unwell physically, but didn't mention her psychological symptoms. She said she'd taken medication throughout the day, hoping to feel better. But by the time she went to bed, she was still feeling poorly and still having suicidal thoughts. She said she'd had a restless night's sleep that night, and when she woke up on Friday, she still felt terrible. Rehetile said her whole body was aching and her headache was still there. She'd taken Mypaid Forte and Migral on an empty stomach and dropped her children off at school. She drove back home and found that her husband was not there. She says that this made her feel very alone again, and the emotional darkness from the day before once again descended on her. She phoned her husband, and the conversation they had would be presented in several different ways in future statements. On the phone, Maxwell said he was at a building supply store buying a few things for the house build. The couple then apparently got into a disagreement about something relating to one of the bathrooms in the house they were building. At different times in this case, Rehetile would say that her husband had told her he would leave her and the children to live in the house alone if she persisted with her stance. Later in court, Rehetile would deny that he had phrased this way, and so would Maxwell. She would deny that there was any seriousness to their disagreements on the phone that morning, but her interpretation of those conversations directly after the crime in question, which we'll get to, of course, was far more serious. She said that she'd felt suicidal again on this day, but her thoughts of harm were never directed at anyone except herself. She used the inhaler and took pain medication again, but felt no better. Around lunchtime, she'd made herself a sandwich, but was only able to eat half. She'd had a glass of red wine with her lunch as well. Then, she said that these suicidal thoughts had overwhelmed her, and she'd gone to fetch her husband's gun from the safe. Maxwell Machiane would later say that he kept his gun locked in the gun safe, which was secured by a digital code. He would later testify that he'd always kept the gun fully loaded with 5 bullets. Rehetile did have the code to the safe, but both she and her husband said she'd never handled the gun before. She says that after she retrieved the gun, she'd gone to sit in her car with it and had contemplated shooting herself. She then decided that she should rather distract herself from her sadness and suicidal thoughts by going to Pick n Pay. She placed the gun in the boot of the car and drove to Pick n Pay Silverton, where she purchased a few items, including nappies for her youngest son. Then she drove to Dis-Chem, where she spoke with a pharmacist and explained her physical symptoms as well as detailing the medication she was already taking. The pharmacist recommended Empicod as well as Kathinac. Empicod is a combination of paracetamol and codeine, which is for pain. And Kathinac contains diclofenac potassium and is intended for the treatment of fever or mild to moderate pain of inflammatory origin. She purchased these 2 medications and also bought another pack of Migral, as well as several medications for her youngest son, who she believed was coming down with flu. Rehetile purchased a can of Red Bull, and when she got back into the car, she took a Migral with the energy drink. When she arrived at her youngest son's school, he was asleep, so she lay down next to him for a little while. When he woke, she drove him home, and there she took the Empicod, Kathinac, and another Migral tablet with the rest of the Red Bull. Then she drove to her older son's school, Her son was at sports practice, and as Rihetile stood on the side of the field, she said that she'd had an almost disassociated view of herself standing there. She would later claim that her last actual memory of the hours that would follow was putting her children in the car and putting their seatbelts on. From reconstruction, we know that from there, Rihetile drove to an isolated area near Hammanskraal and pulled the car over. What followed was pieced together from the evidence on the scene. And I will warn you that this is difficult to listen to. At some point, Rihetile took the gun out of the boot of the car and walked around to the passenger side of the vehicle where her two-year-old son, Alvaro, was sitting. She raised the gun and fired a shot into the child's head. The pathologist would later record that the bullets had entered Alvaro's left eye and travelled through his brain, exiting out the back of his skull. He would likely have died from this devastating wound almost immediately. Then Rihetile moved to the back of the car, where her older son, 5-year-old Keandre, must have been well aware that something truly terrible was happening. The first shot fired at Keandre hit him in his arm. Devastatingly, this was likely because he was holding his arm up in a defensive position as his mother aimed the gun at him. The bullet went straight through his arm and into the back of the driver's seat. The force of the bullet either flung the child from the car and onto the ground outside if the car door was open, or he had fled from the car himself. But he didn't get very far. His mother must have moved around the car and fired again. This time, the bullet struck his head. Rihetile must have been standing relatively close to her son when she fired the gun the second time, as there was tattooing of gunshot residue around the wound. Sadly, Keandre did not die as quickly as his brother. The pathologist would find that there was aspiration of blood into the child's lungs, as well as blood swallowed into his stomach, which means he continued breathing and swallowing for some period of time after being shot. Rihetile would later say, in one version, that she had come to, laying beside Keandre on the ground. She said she found the gun beside her and held it to her head and pulled the trigger twice, but the gun had just clicked. Assuming that there were no bullets left, she said she'd searched the field around the car for something to kill herself with. She claimed to have found a beer bottle and tried to break it so she could stab herself, but weathered by the sun, the bottle had shattered into tiny pieces. Then, she would claim, in a later version, that she'd sat in the front seat of her car and swallowed all of the various medications she had on her. Then, she'd started running. Mrs. Van Rooyen was in the kitchen of her home, which was approximately 2.4 kilometers from where Rihetile had just shot her children, when she saw the face of a woman appear in her window. She was immediately concerned because her yard was secured, and anyone getting in would have to have squeezed through her fence. Mrs. Van Rooyen said that Rihetile almost immediately asked her if she had a bullet for her. She told the woman she didn't have any bullets, but concerned that the woman may be armed, she asked where her gun was. Rihetile ignored the question and instead asked if she could have a knife, as she'd like to kill herself. Mrs. Van Rooyen said that she would not help her to kill herself, and Rihetile said that was fine. She would go to a nearby highway and throw herself in front of a car. She started moving toward a wall, which, if she scaled it, would put her within a stone's throw of the highway. And Mrs. Van Rooyen picked up the phone and called Hammanskraal police on her cell phone while running outside to prevent Rihetile from climbing the wall. She was able to pull her down and spoke to her calmly to try and get the woman to stop, seemingly trying to take her life. She asked her why she wanted to kill herself and was horrified at the woman's response. I shot my children, but I didn't have enough bullets to kill myself. She went on to say that if she didn't kill herself, her husband would kill her. Mrs. Van Rooyen was able to maintain her composure and asked why she'd killed her children. Rehetile told her that her husband was cheating on her and planned to leave her and give her children to this other woman to raise. Mrs. Van Rooyen phoned the community policing organization which serviced the area and spoke with a Mr. Dorfling. He instructed her to ask the woman where the car was and if she was sure the children were dead. Rehetile told the woman the car was on the same plot of land she'd lived on and she could direct police there. And yes, she was sure the children were dead, she said, because she'd shot her youngest child once and the older child twice. Both Dorfling and the police first sought out the vehicle before going to Mrs. Van Rooyen's house. She confirmed that she had the woman secured, and for them it was important to ensure that the children were indeed beyond saving before doing anything else. They easily located the blue BMW, and sadly, both children were declared dead by paramedics who'd been called just in case. Mrs. Van Rooyen said that Rehetile had asked if she could use her phone, and she'd phoned her mother. During the time that she was at the woman's house, Mrs. Van Rooyen said Rehetile had spoken multiple languages. Mrs. Van Rooyen described Rehetile as looking out of breath at first, but generally calm. She said the woman didn't cry while she was speaking to her and did have some white substance around her mouth. She said that despite the shocking and disturbing content of the conversation, Rehetile was coherent in her speech and she was rational. She also said her clothes were clean and she couldn't see any blood or dirt on them. Mr. Dorfling's testimony reflected much of what Mrs. Van Rooyen said. Rehetile had also told him that she killed her boys and that she wanted to kill herself before her husband did. Captain Mokgapa was one of the first senior responders from the SAPS to arrive at the scene that day. She'd been employed with the SAPS for 27 years and had understandably seen some terrible things by the time she arrived at Rehetile's blue BMW around 4:45 that afternoon. But she would say it was one of the most disturbing things she'd ever seen. Mokgapa said that when she met Rehetile Matiane, the woman had immediately confessed to her that she had killed her children and asked her to please help her end her life as well. Mokgapa interrupted her and advised her that she was a police officer and explained her rights to her before she could say anything further to incriminate herself. She then told Rehetile that she was going to put her in her police vehicle for her own safety. Rehetile would remain locked in the vehicle until she was taken to the police station later on. Captain Mokgapa said that she'd regularly checked up on the woman, and she said she'd been fine. After having visited the site of the murder again, Mokgapa had spoken with Rehetile, and the woman had told her that she'd been in a bad marriage for 12 years, and she believed her husband was about to leave her for another woman and take her children away. Maxwell Matiane was at the building site of the family's new home when he received a call from a number he didn't recognize that afternoon. He initially missed the call, but called back about half an hour later, and a woman on the other side of the line told him that she was with his wife, and she was sorry to inform him that his sons had been shot to death by Rehetile. Maxwell said he was so shocked that at first he'd hung up on the woman. After a few minutes, he called back and asked for the vehicle registration number. She read it out, and he knew that the terrible news he was being given was true. When Maxwell arrived on the scene, he said he'd tried to talk to his wife, and she'd been incoherent, and he'd noticed that she'd vomited and urinated in the back seat of the vehicle. He didn't attempt to speak with her again until several days later, when he was allowed to visit her in prison. He also didn't ask her what had happened or why she'd done what she had until days later. The gun which Riatile had used to kill her children was found inside the vehicle, along with her cell phone, her laptop, and a half-empty bottle of water. Despite her claims of having consumed all the medication she had on her, there's no mention made of empty packs of medication in the car. But this lack of information was not the only problematic handling of the scene that day. The prosecutor on the case would later imply that it seemed as though the police officers on the case had thought the case was a bit of a slam dunk because Riatile had admitted to committing the crime. And as a result, forensics within the car, which was essentially the scene of the crime, were not carried out correctly. Thankfully, photographs were taken, but a forensic officer later trying to use these photographs would say they were extremely low quality, and he'd spent a lot of time trying to enhance them so that he could show the court what had actually happened inside the car. But the photographs were all that was done to the car. No blood pattern analysis was done or trajectory tests on the bullets. In fact, Maxwell Matiane was allowed to collect the vehicle the day after the murders. And by the time police contacted him to see if they could get the vehicle back, the seats had already been pulled out and replaced. In the days following the murder of Alvaro and Keandre, Riatile was charged with 2 counts of murder, 1 count of illegal possession of a firearm, and another of illegal possession of ammunition, as she was not licensed to use her husband's firearm. She was granted bail pending a psychiatric assessment, which would be carried out due to the nature of the crime. The prosecution would later say that up until this point, no mention had been made of excessive use of medication possibly having influenced Riatile's behaviour that day. The woman had said that she couldn't remember the incident and only had snapshot memories of what had happened, which were limited to the moment she'd strapped her boys in at their schools, then waking up beside Keandre on the ground, and her attempts at suicide. She said she couldn't remember any conversations with individuals that afternoon, nor could she recall telling anyone that she killed her children because her marriage was unhappy or abusive. In fact, Riatile said that it made no sense that she would say this, because it was blatantly untrue. She had no idea what had come over her that day, she said. She recalled the suicidal ideation she'd had, but in her mind, these had never consciously translated to hurting anyone except herself. And she certainly hadn't made the leap between thinking her husband was planning on leaving her and then ending her children's lives as a result, according to her. It had all been a mystery in her own mind, until she started talking about how she'd felt in the days leading up to the murders, and wondered whether the medication she'd taken had somehow played a role. By the time she was released on bail, it seemed that this was going to be her defense. When the trial would begin, Riatile pleaded not guilty to the charges of murder, and her defense to this was the following. Quote, I deny that during the commission of the crimes I was able to appreciate the wrongfulness of my actions and or act accordingly. I specifically plead that my defense to the charges is one of sane automatism due to a short-lasting psychotic depressive episode with prominent suicidal trends as a result of a combination of side effects of medication and substance intake. I specifically plead that the side effects of the medication and or substances were unknown to me prior to the commission of the offense. I state that the combination of the side effects to the medication and or substances caused a short-lasting but severe substance-induced psychotic depressive episode with prominent destructive and suicidal trends. I state that the combination of the side effects of the medication and or substances had the following effects on me with the feelings of melancholia, suicidal thoughts, temporary memory loss, and impaired judgment. I have partial memory loss of the events leading up to the shooting incidents and thereafter. I have no recollection of the shooting incidents itself. End quote. Now, that's a mouthful, and I'll break down what it actually means. But first, I wanted to also mention something else that was said in Riatile's plea statement, which had me confused for a moment. She stated that she was the mother of one child, a girl. That threw me when I first read it, because I was pretty certain I hadn't missed any children from previous relationships on her side in my research. And then I saw the child's age, as at the start of the trial, 10 months old. The child had been born in January 2017. Maxwell and Rihetile would later explain in their respective testimonies that they had made a conscious decision to have another child, and she'd fallen pregnant while out on bail about a year after shooting her boys. Maxwell would say that he and his wife were still very happily married, despite what had happened, and he felt that her actions on the day of the murders were completely out of character, and while he couldn't explain it, he had still wanted to remain married to her and have more children with her. Now, back to that complex defense. Although Rihetile had already undergone a psychiatric assessment that declared her fit to stand trial and also found that she had not been suffering from any mental illness at the time of the crime that would have meant she did not understand the difference between right and wrong, Rihetile was saying that the latter was not entirely correct. And she had indeed had a form of episode which had caused her to act outside of her full cognition. Specifically, she'd said she'd experienced a brief state of a very rare condition called automatism. The term automatism is used to describe behavior that occurs when a person is acting unconsciously and they are unaware that the act is taking place. The act is not voluntary and there is no intent to commit the act. An example of this would be someone who murders their spouse while sleepwalking. Riatile's plea further explained that this sane automatism was likely caused by what her experts would refer to as an idiosyncratic reaction to the combination of medicine she'd taken on the day and in the run-up to the murders. By idiosyncratic, her defense indicated that they acknowledged that there would likely not be many or indeed any others who had had such a reaction to the medicine combination, but they hoped to show that Rihetile had experienced such a reaction. What they were seeking was a ruling of what is called non-pathological incapacity, which means that the accused was not responsible for their actions at the time of the crime for reasons that are not acutely psychiatric and occurred only in that moment, which means they are no longer a threat to society. In addition to this, Rihetile said that she'd experienced amnesia around the incident, which is not uncommon when true automatism is experienced, considering the brain is acting without conscious thought and therefore unlikely to record memory. Two types of experts would play an incredibly important role in this trial: mental health experts, including psychiatrists and psychologists, and also experts in substances, or toxicologists. The state would present their experts, and the defense would present theirs. And the most convincing arguments of the two would sway the decision as to whether what Rihetile had admitted to doing was actually murder or not. And if it was it premeditated? This, of course, would make all the difference when it came to what the judge decided she was guilty of and what type of sentence she would get. For the most part, the evidence presented outside of these two types of experts was not in dispute, mainly because Rihetile claimed to have no memory of anything the witnesses, such as Mrs. Van Rooyen and the police officers, were testifying to. But when the psychiatrist for the prosecution and the expert in toxicology presented their evidence, this would certainly be disputed by the defense. One of the experts presented by the defense with regard to the medication aspect was Dr. Brink. Brink approached the matter from an admittedly academic perspective and had gone about determining whether, if the information he'd been given was correct, was there any possibility that the combination of medicines could have led Riatile to act in the way she had. It would emerge during his testimony that the information he'd been given about the amount of medication Riatile had consumed was different to what she told other experts. His ultimate determination was that the Migril especially, and perhaps even the Symbicort, could possibly have interacted together in an individual to create certain types of out-of-character behavior. He did underpin that possibility with saying that it would be very random. A later expert in toxicology for the prosecution, however, Dr. Miller, put that possibility in perspective by saying it would be the same possibility that a meteor would crash right into the court building at that very moment. So, not impossible, but very unlikely. Dr. Miller had extensive experience at the Tigerberg Clinic of Toxicology and would also refute any information presented by other experts who testified, including those on behalf of the defense. One of the most alarming pieces of information presented was by one of the defense's experts, who was actually a psychiatrist, but had seen fit to focus on the toxicology aspect in his report as well. He testified about a study that had been conducted linked to one of the ingredient families contained in the Symbicort inhaler. I actually found this study myself before reading the judgment containing this information, and with my very non-expert view, was also quite alarmed as it detailed five different cases in which individuals had committed either violent crimes or behaved completely out of character in some way after using an ingredient seemingly contained in Symbicort. And this is why I suspect the defense's expert was also very much untrained in toxicology, because they would present the study as factual evidence that Riatile had been driven to kill her children by the asthma inhaler she'd used. But Dr. Miller would point out that this was completely incorrect. Although the ingredient mentioned in the study was in the same family of ingredients as contained in the inhaler, it wasn't the same substance, and it had a completely different molecular structure. In addition, those five cases related to individuals who had consumed the steroid orally, not through means of inhalation. This makes a huge difference to the distribution and impact of an ingredient on the human body. Dr. Miller said that there was absolutely no cases reported where a Symbicort inhaler had led to psychiatric dysfunction. Dr. Miller ended his testimony with some poignant words, which even the judge would refer back to later. He said that there was a lot of mention of suicide in the proceedings, but that, quote, nobody mentions homicide for some or other reason, end quote. He said that he couldn't find any association between the drugs and the medicines used by the accused, and the induction of homicide. In the last 40 years working in the Tigerberg Pharmacology and Toxicology Consultation Center, he had not come across a case where the consumption of the mentioned drugs that the accused consumed led to the induction of homicide. The other medication ingredients Brink and the defense's expert had pointed to possibly contributing to Riatile's behavior was ergotamine, which is in the Migril. Brink had indicated that this ingredient had been pulled from use in many countries across the world or had been made a prescription drug due to the adverse psychiatric effects that had been identified in some users. In South Africa, Migral is an over-the-counter drug. Brink testified to accounts where ergotamine was found to have resulted in psychotic episodes. Again, Muller put this testimony into context by saying that in those rare instances, ergotamine had only resulted in psychiatric side effects where the individual using the drug had already had existing psychiatric issues. The ingredient had actually not caused such effects in anyone who was previously psychiatrically healthy. In addition, all of these adverse accounts resulted from doses way exceeding the recommended dose. As several psychiatrists, including her own witnesses, would later testify, Diatile had no pre-existing diagnosed mental health conditions, and both she and her husband, a qualified psychiatrist, had said that she'd never struggled with even symptoms of any mental health conditions. In addition, as all the toxicology evidence had relied on Rihatile's own accounts about how much medication she'd taken, she had been the one who'd said, although she didn't know exactly how many tablets she'd had, she could not remember a time in her life where she'd exceeded the recommended daily dose of Migral. The only time she may have actually exceeded it was if, when she claimed she'd taken all the tablets she had on her in the car, she'd taken a lot of Migral then. But that was after the murders, and she soon vomited that out anyway. Rihatile had psychiatric experts of her own to present, including a psychiatrist her husband had referred her to, who worked in the same building as him. The defense would rely on these experts to build upon their claim that she'd been acting in an automatic state at the time of the murders. Between the psychiatrists and those who testified for the state, a battle of theories would happen around what qualified as automatic behavior. As I've explained before when I talk about serial offender psychology, there are several schools of thought in psychology, and depending on which school a particular mental health expert follows, you'll get slightly varied reasoning and explanations about the root causes of mental health issues, and sometimes even the criteria that should be checked off to identify it. One example is the McDonald's triad, which is a set of three behaviors first proposed by psychiatrist J.M. McDonald in 1963, which he claimed, and many mental health and criminology experts believed for decades to come, would predict the development of a serious violent offender if exhibited in childhood. The three behaviors are animal abuse, fire setting, and bedwetting. Today, the vast majority of forensic psychologists and psychiatrists no longer follow this theory, but some still do, and will defend it. Another example is Stockholm Syndrome. Many mental health providers now believe that Stockholm Syndrome actually does not exist, and instead it is a combination of behaviors which are seen predominantly in female victims, because women are more likely to follow the fawn response rather than just fight or flight, and also because coercive control is now far better understood. In this case, automatism was on the table for discussion. Rehetile's experts were following a set of criteria for automatism set up by a British neuropsychiatrist and neurophysiologist named Peter Fenwick, while the state's experts stuck more closely to a set of criteria named by a South African psychiatrist whose name will likely be familiar to many avid true crime consumers, Sean Kaliski. Professor Kaliski is the head of the forensic psychiatric units at Falkenberg Hospital and associate professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cape Town. In his book, Psycho-Legal Assessment, he details the suggested assessment criteria for a range of mental health conditions from a legal perspective. Kaliski has done thousands of psycholegal assessments himself, but did not rely solely on his own experiences for the book, and had 22 contributors in total who were all experts in various psychiatric fields. One of the psychiatrists who had assessed Riatile at Vescorpi's psychiatric hospital was called to testify by the state. Dr. Pooh is a specialist psychiatrist at the University of Pretoria, and her long list of accolades and experience was read into the record on the day of her testimony. Rehetile's defense counsel had initially objected to this evidence being heard in court because they claimed that she had not been aware of her rights and had not known that what she told the psychiatrist during her assessment would not be confidential, as was the case with other interactions with mental health practitioners. The judge considered this, but soon came to the conclusion that Rehetile was a well-educated woman who communicated well in several different languages. She also worked as a practice manager for her husband, whose psychiatric work was often psycholegal in nature, relating to road accident fund claims. He determined that there was no way that Rehetile did not understand the nature of the assessment she was undergoing. In addition, when Dr. Pooh began to testify, it became clear that the woman was also given preferential treatment due to her husband being a psychiatrist, and she'd not been held in a secure ward where she would be subjected to harsh restrictions, and instead was put in an open ward with patients who were not deeply mentally ill or violent in any way. Dr. Pooh's overall assessment of Rehetile's mental states around the time of the crime was that she'd behaved completely normally and rationally right up until the point of shooting her children. The doctor acknowledged Rehetile's claim that she could not remember anything after strapping her children into the car. She did point out that her actions on the day were precise and purposeful, and she was able to safely operate a vehicle for quite some time. Rehetile mentioned to Dr. Pooh that on the call she'd had with her husband, she'd misinterpreted a comment he'd made about leaving her to live alone in their new house to mean that he was going to abandon her. It seemed that this was an important piece of information she hadn't wanted to be put on the record, because up until this point, she hadn't acknowledged that she'd subconsciously thought her husband was going to leave her, nor that there were any issues between them that day. Rather, she'd told the court that she didn't remember anything like that, and could only explain the things she'd said to the witnesses as being as a result of her altered mental state. But in her assessment, unaltered and not on any medication, she admitted to having misinterpreted what Maxwell had said. Dr. Pooh said that she couldn't find anything to support the defense's psychiatrist's assessment of Rehetile speaking in a muddled and disorientated manner, as she was easily able to remember and provide the full names and telephone numbers of several people she wanted witnesses to phone for her. Dr. Pooh, having been told that the versions Rehetile's psychiatrist had of the day's events were patently different in places to what she'd been told in the assessment, and we'll get to that in a bit, said that this seemed to point to the distinct possibility that Rehetile had not been truthful with anyone about what had happened. As far as Rehetile's amnesia around the event was concerned, Dr. Pooh said that she could find no evidence from the woman's account and the behaviours that had been presented to her to support a case of amnesia. In addition, when considering the sane automatism claim, the doctor said that the phenomenon was incredibly rare, and in all the cases she'd looked at, the state of automatic action had started and ended with the crime in question. The individuals were always able to recount exactly what had occurred right up until the moment of the criminal action, and immediately afterwards also had their memory. The loss of memory did not include a long period before and after, as Rehetile had reported. Another inconsistency that emerged from Dr. Poo's report regarding Rihetile's version was the mention of her having taken a load of medication after shooting the children. Although I've mentioned this throughout the episode, it was first entered into evidence in the trial when Dr. Poo testified, and hadn't been something that Rihetile told anyone else, not even her own psychiatrists, nor in her own testimony. The automatism claim would eventually be broken down and compared to Rehetile's actual behaviour on the day of the crime. Firstly, as Dr. Poo mentioned, it would be unlikely that Rehetile's claim of amnesia and only having snapshot memory were descriptors of automatism, as they didn't fit other descriptions of loss of memory around automatic behaviour. In addition, of course, when each of the witnesses' and experts' accounts were put out side by side, it became clear that the snapshot memories and moments of alleged amnesia were inconsistent. Rehetile initially said that she could only remember strapping her children in and then waking up next to her son on the ground. And then she remembered running and arriving at the Van Rooyen residence, but nothing after that until she found herself in a prison cell the next day. But she told Dr. Poo a few months after the event that she remembered calling for her children and taking medication in the car. This information was left out of her accounts to her own psychiatrists, and to them, her memory was even more sparse. But to the witnesses, she'd been able to say that her boys were definitely both dead, and she even knew how many times she'd shot them. In other accounts, she remembered holding the gun to her own head and hearing a clicking sound. These contrasting accounts and added in bits, at least to the qualified professionals, seemed to point to the fact that she'd not been truthful from the beginning about how much she could remember, which brought into question the entire claim of amnesia. Another key element of automatism, according to Professor Kaliski, is that the tasks completed in an automated state will only be things that a person has done before. In other words, it's not possible for an individual who, and this is a silly example but shows the point, has never baked a loaf of bread before to suddenly be able to do so in an automated state. Automatic behaviour must be just that. No thinking required. So you must be able to use some form of learned action or muscle memory to complete the automatic action. Of course, people do commit murder in an automatic state rarely, but it has happened. But someone who has no knowledge of poisons, for instance, could not claim that they were able to measure out and dispense a deadly poison to their victim during an automatic episode. By the same token, according to the criteria, Rehetile, who had never held a gun before that day, let alone shot one, would not have been able to fire a gun the way she did in an automatic state. The expert advice presented indicated that even if she had somehow been able to get the first gunshot off, that would have snapped her out of the state of automatism, and she would not have been able to shoot her other son in the same state. Also, if the actions had been automatic, she would not have enough conscious thought to know to fire a second shot. Automatic states presume that intention does not exist. If you're acting automatically, you do not intend to do whatever it is you end up doing during that episode, and are therefore not criminally responsible for it. But having the formed thought that you have only wounded your child and must therefore walk around the car, get closer, and shoot him again, this time in the head, in order to kill him, indicates that the intention to kill exists. In addition, Rehetile's defense claimed that the trip to the rural area must have also been part of this automatic behavior, because she said she couldn't remember it. Of course, from a legal defence perspective, it's important for that part of the crime to fall under something the accused cannot control. Because if she purposefully drove her children 20 kilometres through toll roads and made conscious decisions about paths she would take to seemingly get to the most remote place possible with a gun in the boot, that could equate to premeditation. Of course, as the psych experts would explain, this trip could not have been part of the automatic behaviour because it involved too much thinking and decision-making. Rihetile had apparently never been to the place where she killed her children before, and she certainly didn't drive the road every day. It couldn't have been one of those you just zone out and find yourself in your driveway things. She was doing this for the first time, like she was firing a gun for the first time. It was so unlikely that it was close to impossible that anyone could accomplish that drive without incidents in an automatic state. Another part of Rihetile's behaviour that didn't fit the automatism criteria was how she behaved after the crime. For the most part, once individuals snap out of an automatic episode, they are horrified at what they see in front of them because they are essentially seeing it for the first time with their conscious mind. Individuals would be unlikely to immediately assume that they've committed the murder they see before them and would be far more likely to try and get help for their loved ones. In some instances, of course, it could be obvious you'd done it if you're covered in blood or come to while still stabbing someone, for instance. But Rihetile claimed she'd came to laying next to her son on the ground and the gun was beside her. If the thought of killing her children had never crossed her mind, then it would be far more likely that her first thought would be, "I've been hijacked and someone has shot my children." And she would pick up her cell phone and call for help. But she didn't do that. She immediately knew that she had killed them and went on an apparent journey not to get help for them, but to find a way to end her own life. With the automatism caused by medication a quickly waning theory, one of the psychiatrists Rihetile had seen as part of her own defense had an adjusted version he believed was possible. Dr. Savov is a specialist psychiatrist in full-time practice. He was a colleague of Maxwell Machane and had been asked to treat and assess Rihetile after the murders. His testimony would focus quite a bit on the effects he believed the medication had on her, but these would all be refuted by the prosecution's toxicology witness. In addition, he did believe that there had been automatic behaviour, but also that the depressed state and suicidality that Rihetile had mentioned feeling on and off in the days preceding the murders had possibly merged with the automatism to create a situation that's known as altruistic filicide, or extended suicide. Essentially, when filicide, the killing of one's own child, is committed with the motive that the parent feels they're doing what's best for the child, and this is considered filicide with a believed altruistic motive. Offenders who commit crimes like this almost feel like they're committing suicide on behalf of their children by murdering them, hence the extended suicide term. This is what Savov believed happened with Rihetile. The medication had put her into a short-term period of depression, which had resulted in suicidal ideation, and when the combination of medications had caused a period of automatism, the suicidal ideation had extended to taking her children with her. It's important at this point to mention, as the judge would, that Dr. Savov, despite being a very well-respected psychiatrist with many years of experience, was not a registered forensic psychiatrist, and yet he was testifying from what he had labelled a forensic psychiatry report on Rihetile Machane. Dr. Savov seemed a little surprised when he realized in cross-examination that he hadn't actually had all of the information about the medication, and also that Rihatile had given witnesses a reason for killing her children, which amounted to the fact that her husband was going to leave her. To his credit, he seemed to quite seamlessly absorb this into his theory, saying that it made even more sense then that she would be depressed and suicidal. But of course, this completely went against the theory that it was the medication that had made her depressed and suicidal. Rihatile Matyane did not have a depressive disorder. She had never suffered from one before or even after her children's death. That is not a diagnosable clinical depression, not a situational depression caused by grief. If Savov's theory was to be believed, she had very suddenly had an onset of incredible depression just a few minutes before her children were shot, and then quickly recovered from the depression a few minutes afterwards. Dr. Savov did not believe that Rihatile had committed the crimes from a revenge-focused motive, because he said she wouldn't have then tried to kill herself afterwards. And he also said that there was no history of this type of behavior in their marriage or extramarital affairs. Now, just from my very non-professional view, we actually very often see offenders, more often male than female, but female too, killing their children and then themselves, and doing so in a manner that is clearly an attack on the surviving partner or parent. That is not uncommon at all. So to say that Rihatile wanting to take her own life makes a motive of revenge impossible is, in my view, not correct. And the judge would come to a similar conclusion. Additionally, it was also incorrect to say that there was no history of revenge-taking behavior in their relationship or extramarital affairs. Rihatile admitted herself that the interim protection order she'd taken out just before they got married was a warning of sorts to Maxwell not to mess with her. Also, Rihatile and Maxwell had actually started their relationship, by their own admission, while he was still married to his wife, and they remained in that extramarital relationship state for many years until he eventually divorced her. So, yes, there was definitely a history of that type of behavior too. Another expert who presented evidence for the defense was one Dr. Kariiki. And it was during his evidence that it became clear to the court that it was from his assessment that the idea to use medication as a defense had emanated. When the various versions were placed chronologically in order of what had been said to whom and when, the unintended intoxication defense only came into the picture after Dr. Kariiki had suggested to Rihatile that this is what had happened to her. Something that I think is a very important point, which didn't really seem to be focused too much on in the court, is that there's really no evidence that Rihatile actually did intend to commit suicide or had experienced suicidal ideation at all, except for her own claims that she did. The claims of the overdose were only ever mentioned to Dr. Poo. There were actually no physical injuries to Rihatile's body at all in respect of self-harm. And something bugs me about the gun as well. Rihatile had said that she tried to shoot herself at the scene after killing her children, but the gun had just clicked. The gun took 5 bullets. She used 3 to kill her children. And the police confirmed that when they found the gun in the car, it had contained 5 spent bullets in the cylinder. But Maxwell Matyane testified that he'd always stored his gun fully loaded, with all 5 live bullets. So then there should have been two bullets left. Of course, Maxwell may have been mistaken, but he said he rarely used the gun, so that's probably unlikely. And he does come across as a pretty precise man from his testimony. So when and where were the other two bullets fired? If Riatile claimed that there were none left for her to take her own life with. Now, this is all really neither here nor there. And, as I said, wouldn't really even be discussed in court as far as I can tell. But if you're going to claim you wanted to kill yourself, it of course wouldn't do if police found a gun that still had two live bullets in it on the scene, would it? You might have to, I don't know, randomly fire the gun into the ground or the air in a really remote place twice to get rid of those two bullets. Or not. I don't know. In handing down judgments, Judge Fabricius said that he'd found that the accused was neither an honest nor reliable witness, and she did not hesitate to lie when it suited her. He said that he was of the opinion that her medication-related defense had only started when one of her own psychiatrists had suggested it may be an explanation, and this was why there were so many contradictions about how much medication she'd actually taken between the various reports, because she didn't know it was going to be an important element until she decided to go with it as a defense. The judge also said that on the day of the murders, she'd been able to communicate well with everyone around her, and it clearly indicated her motive there and then. All of the contradictions and proof of improbabilities I've already mentioned here were also raised by the judge, and he said that her version was not reasonably possibly true given the evidence. He said that from a toxicology expert's evidence, it was clear that if there had been any impact by the drugs in question, that impact would have been sustained long past the killing of the boys. It would not have just disappeared moments after. The judge conceded that if there was any type of memory loss, it may have been post the event and related to the self-inflicted trauma of killing her children. But there was no deep psychological cause for this, and it certainly would not have contributed to the crime. He summarily rejected the claim that the medication had played any role in the crime and said that to his mind, the first uttered motive was the most true. Rehetile had, for some reason, convinced herself that her husband was going to leave her, or she was angry at him for some other unknown reason, and as a result she had decided to kill the children and possibly herself. He found that she had acted with intention and complete understanding of what she was doing and had tried to cover up her intentionality in the aftermath. As a result, he found her guilty of two counts of murder as well as the firearms charges. Although Rihetile had been out on bail up until that point, her bail was now ended when she was found guilty. She did, however, ask for permission to apply for bail again until her sentencing. As her reason, she said that her baby was still breastfeeding and she needed to care for the child. The judge was quick to deny this. He said that she and her husband had made a conscious decision to have another child when she still had the trial hanging over her head. He said that by her own description, her husband was a competent and excellent father, and he certainly had the resources to hire assistants to care for the child if he needed to. The judge refused bail. In sentencing, a psychologist's report focused on Rihetile's personality and added perhaps a little more context to her behaviour that day. The report states, quote, Mrs. Matane's interpersonal style seems best characterized as being domineering and over-controlling. She has strong needs to control others and expects respect and admiration in return. She may be driven to appear competent and authoritative, and likely has little tolerance for those who disagree with her plans and desires. Others probably view her as being rather overbearing and dictatorial. Although able to express some degree of warmth, her need to be in control in relationships probably taxes the endurance of those who are close to her. End quote. The judge would say that in his view, this could be read in conjunction with what Rihetsile had said at the scene, in that, essentially, if she couldn't have her children, no one would. The judge also expressed in sentencing that in his mind the crimes were premeditated, as she'd taken the gun with her and driven to an isolated spot. With regard to Rihetsile having been in an abusive marriage and possibly fearing for her own life, the judge said he could make no ruling to include that as a mitigating factor because the offender herself had refused to admit there was any issue in her marriage other than at the scene. Her legal counsel, perhaps in a last-ditch attempt to steer his clients to a lesser sentence, had claimed that the accused was clearly protecting her husband to her own detriment. But he was unable to provide any evidence of this, and the judge could not consider it at all in determining his sentence. If that was the case, he said, the offender should have been truthful and taken the court into her confidence. The judge also took into consideration victim impact reports from family members of the boys, as well as a group of secondary victims, which included children and teachers from the boys' schools, and police officers who'd been at the scene. It was clear that the circumstances of Alvaro and Keandre's deaths had wide-reaching effects, and understandably so. With this, Judge Fabricius handed down two life sentences to Rihetsile Matsiane. Despite this case having so much information, I reach the near end of this episode still a little befuddled. I understand what did not lead to the murders, but I'm still not sure I understand what did. Sure, we don't have to know motive, but when it's a parent and their own children, I'm sure it's not just me that would like a clearer answer. I tried to compare this case to other similar cases of filicide, and I came up short. There are cases where mothers have killed their children for selfish reasons, and there's absolutely no mental health defense. But in those cases, it's usually pretty cut and dry. As with male offenders of a similar nature, you can see the trail of abusive behavior leading up to it. But here, there's just nothing. And then everything implodes in the worst way possible. Or at least, that's how it appears from the outside. And maybe that's the key. Maybe what we're seeing from the outside is not the truth. Perhaps there was a build-up, and there were other things that indicated there was a problem building, and we'll just never know. I found myself sifting through the mountain of evidence in this case, almost holding my breath and hoping that somewhere along the line there would be an explanation. But the best I could find was a deep desire for power and control, which, let's face it, is at the foundation of so many of the crimes I cover. So maybe it's not that mysterious after all. Rihetsile Matsiane started a PhD program from prison. In April 2024, Monarch Business School in Switzerland published a link to her research proposal for her PhD entitled Assessing the Socioeconomic Impact of Female Recidivism on the Attainment of Sustainable Development Goals, a gender-responsive study at the Johannesburg Female Correctional Centre in South Africa. Strangely, in the bio on that page, it notes that Rehetile is the CEO of Matyane Medico Legal Clinic, which is weird. Also, nowhere on the page does it mention that she's actually incarcerated in the facility she's doing the research at. But I guess that's maybe not relevant. I've downloaded her research, and I'm sure I'll find some value in it. I do not see any notes about appeals she may have undertaken. Her request to appeal her conviction was denied immediately upon the judgment being handed down, but I don't see anything about an appeal being requested on sentencing, if that was requested. To the best of my knowledge, despite having a current job title on a Swiss university page, she is still incarcerated and should be eligible for parole in 2042. And if you have any different information about that, please do let me know. Reading about these secondary victims in this case made me think about how you would even begin to explain to your child why their friend is no longer in school with them. Certainly, Alvaro's little friends at school, just 2 years old, probably wouldn't have needed much information. But Keandre's friends, at 5 or 6 years old, could have already been absorbing things that they were hearing around them about how their friend had died. Firstly, just trying to understand the death of someone your own age at that time is confusing enough. But what if they heard his mommy killed him? How do you explain that to a 5 or 6 year old who sees their parents as their safe haven? That's Keandre's mommy ended his life. What processes would they have to go through in their young minds to even begin to fathom that, if we as adults can't even understand it? And then, how do you explain to them that they don't have to worry because you would never do something like that to them? Because I'm pretty sure Keandre never dreamed that was possible until he witnessed her doing it to his brother. So if Keandre wasn't safe when he thought he was, why would any child think they are? Alvaro Matyane, Keandre Matyane, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon. Thanks again to this week's sponsor, When Change Happens. To hear amazing stories of change, go to changepodcasts.co.za. I'm sure you'll enjoy the show.